You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, awesome, amiable, and acute aficionados. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 10. And of course, I'm your humble host, Karen. And along with me are...
I'm Colin.
Dana.
And I'm Chris.
We are your... We got alliteration. I didn't forget that. We are your quintessential quizzical quartet of qualified quotable questioners.
Wow.
That little bit of alliteration was from listeners Randy and Janine, who emailed in. And you have to say, we've been getting a lot of emails with some awesome alliteration, so keep them coming.
So we have to outsource our alliteration now?
I love them.
Well, it's just, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's just so much cheaper overseas.
It's true. We can't compete with that.
And speaking of listeners and mail, we issued another listener challenge last week, and Colin?
Yeah, so this one worked out even better than we had hoped. So the challenge, just to very quickly recap, it was at the end of a double letter quiz. I had said there were two words, 12 letter words that you can type just using your left hand on a standard keyboard layout. And we were actually looking for the answer we were looking for was stewardesses with the double S there to fit the criterion of double letters.
A little bit politically incorrect.
I suppose they're flight attendants these days, or maybe even for a while now. But several listeners went above and beyond the call of duty. So we also had submitted one that I didn't even have in mind, which is After Effects.
Did you verify it?
I did. I verified it. It's way older than I thought. I mean, I looked. The earliest cited use of After Effects was in the 1600s.
Whoa.
So it is a bona fide.
It's a word with double letters, too.
Double letters. That's right. No hyphen. Nothing like that. One solid word. So
older than stewardesses, even.
Oh, good point. Good point. So we have so two awesome answers there. So if you put stewardesses or After Effects, you rock.
Yep, we got our winners that we randomly selected. Josh from Australia, Emily from Illinois, Natalia from New York, Genevieve from Montreal, and Chase, who along with others suggested After Effects that we didn't know.
So, well done.
Good job, guys.
You are educating us.
I actually found that I can type every word on the typewriter with only my left hand.
I can do it with just one finger, in fact.
Whoa.
Yeah, we had to weed out the 900 smart-ass answers.
And wow, this is our 10th episode, double digits.
Hard to believe.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I've actually noticed that pub trivia has been blowing up in the podcast world just recently. A couple days ago, NPR just released their pub trivia podcast game show, and the BBC also just released a general trivia podcast. So make sure you get your trivia fixed.
So just let it be noted that we staked out the territory before NPR and BBC.
Yes. It's tough to compete with two of the largest governments in the world. We only had that Kickstarter.
They have
the ability to tax people.
We have stickers.
That's right.
We have stickers to send to listeners.
The internet.
They have the police.
Yeah, that's true.
They can jail us.
Oh, man. All right, let's jump into our general trivia segment. Pop quiz, hot shot. Everybody get your barnyard buzzers ready.
Mine is ready.
All right.
We got our random Trivial Pursuit card here. Blue Wedge, what is Canada's largest province in area?
Ooh. I'm going to guess Alberta.
Incorrect.
Saskatchewan.
Incorrect.
I just like saying Saskatchewan.
It is Quebec.
Oh.
And of course, Prince Edward Island is the smallest province.
Aw.
PEI.
Very, very tiny. Pink Wedge, pop culture. What TV show takes place in a law firm with a unisexed restroom? Dana.
Ally McBeal.
Correct.
Yes.
Yellow Wedge. What was the most popular name for boys born in the United States from 1961 through 1998?
Wow. Is it Michael?
Correct!
Oh, wow. All right. Shot in the dark there.
You grew up with a lot of Michaels.
I did grow up with a lot of Michaels. I know many Mikes and Michaels. Yeah. Huh.
Jacob became the most popular boy's name in 1999. All right. Purple Wedge. The characters in from the mixed up files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankenweiler.
Basil Frankenweiler.
Sorry. Beloved children's book.
Yes. Yeah.
Hideout in what museum?
Is it the Met? No. Yes.
Yes.
No, yes, no.
I was like, oh, this would be so embarrassing to not get it right. I love that book.
Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Nice. Yeah.
That was when the two kids camp out
in the bathroom. Yeah. And then
they live in the museum.
Right.
Yep.
Green Wedge for science. And this is kind of topical. What species has the longest tail of any land mammal? It's weird. I mean,
is it like a monkey? I just thought they would have these really long. I just imagine them with these long tails.
No.
The longest tail.
Oh. Is it a lemur?
Incorrect. It is giraffe.
Oh.
Really?
Huh?
I guess that makes sense because they're kind of just scaled up.
Right. Okay, sure.
Oh, that's a really good one.
That's good.
So if you draw a picture of a giraffe, make sure you put the tail on there. It's the longest. Mm.
Or if you're playing pin the tail on a giraffe at your birthday party.
Yeah, right. You have to drag it across the floor.
Kids are like tripping over it. Okay, last question. What fitness practice uses the electric chair, spine corrector, and ladder barrel?
Fitness practice?
Oh.
Colin buzzed
in. I was going to guess chiropractic, but I that's not what I was.
Yoga.
Close, but
Pilates.
I didn't buzz.
Yeah. I figured they were yoga positions.
Dana got
that's
it.
What I thought.
some pilates.
Pilates.
Yeah. Pilates. All right, we have our Kickstarter backer question. This is from Josh Hicks, actually from Saskatchewan.
Uh-huh. Oh,
your favorite word. Frank Edwin Wright III is the drummer of what band? And the hint, he's better known by a pseudonym. Frank Edwin Wright III.
By a pseudonym.
And there is a clue in his name.
Frank Edwin Wright III.
Known as by a pseudonym. And there's a clue. Is there a clue in his name to the name of the band or a clue to his pseudonym?
To his pseudonym.
This is...
It seems like it's right on the tip of Dana's tongue.
Okay, I'm guessing, and I also think it's wrong, but I have to say it. Is it U2?
Incorrect.
No, okay.
It is, the band is Green Day, and the drummer is Trey Cool.
What?
The third.
I knew his, they're from Berkeley.
I know, we're recording here in Berkeley. Yeah. We should have gotten that.
Yep. Okay. And Josh is a big music fan, also a big Green Day fan, and a big Apple and Star Wars fan as well.
All right.
Cool. Just like all of us.
Got to meet this guy.
I know, it's right up Colin's alley.
And this one is from Ben Rosenthal from Wyoming, Minnesota. Who was the first U.S. president born in a hospital?
I believe that was Jimmy Carter.
Yes! Where were all the previous presidents born?
At home. At home. I mean,
it wasn't typical to go all the way to the hospital to give birth to a baby.
They just have like midwives come and
yeah, if that.
Conduct their business.
Yeah.
Conduct their business.
Yeah.
Help I'm with sure the lady were... business.
It wasn't considered like an illness to be pregnant, you know? You gave birth to a baby. It happened all the time.
Interesting fact about Ben, he once drank a ham smoothie.
What's the ham smoothie like? I'm curious if it has like vanilla ice cream too.
The bacon milkshake that we talked about last
time. I think it's blend just, up a bunch of ham and soy milk and chug it down.
It's just pureed ham.
Like with the soy milk. Right.
Yeah.
You've gone all the way to liquefying the ham. Yeah. Right. You know, I better lighten this up a little bit with some soy milk.
Yeah. Well, I mean, then it's kosher.
Some yogurt and a banana or something.
Some ice cubes.
Yeah.
All right. And so our topic of the week for our 10th episode is, it's going to be interesting. We're all about weird animals and weird animal stories this week. I'm going to put the disclaimer out there that it might get gross. We've compiled a couple of the, I wouldn't say the weirdest, but it's up there, some of the weirdest animals and animal stories.
So I found this article, and it was called Honeybees exploding testicles, which, of course,
go on.
I had to click on that. That's fascinating. I did not realize this. The way honeybees reproduce, the queen is kind of nurtured in the hive and is fed royal jelly until she becomes sexually mature. And then she does this mating flight, and she has about a dozen male drones with her. And then when they have sex, the male drones like break off their genitalia inside of her and then die.
Oh,
and then the next one comes and he pulls out the genitalia from the one before and then
what?
Like and then they die. They all just
and they just keep doing this.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Now, is each one fertilizing her as it goes?
No, each one is thinking like my testicle won't get stuck in there.
Oh no. This,
the guy before me was dumb.
Oh, no, no. They know what's going to happen.
That is devotion to a cause.
Right? Yeah. I know. Going out with a bang. Like,
that's what you call going balls out.
Or balls deep. Obviously, not all of these male bees successfully impregnate her, right? Or do they all successfully impregnate her?
Or is it, yeah, last one in wins kind of?
No. These are all excellent questions.
You didn't get that far in the article.
I was more focused on like looking at the little picture of the beach in the
Now, it's, you said they explode. What's the explosion? Is it the fact that they break off?
I think that was a very dramatic article title that made me click through.
So it was sensationalistic. Was this the Weekly World News?
No.
What they meant is an explosion of testicles.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So many of them.
No, I verified it. I looked at the different honeybee sites. And
you looked at beetesticles.com.
Yeah, I was looking at all the diagrams. Yeah. It's fascinating. Good Googling.
There are. I mean, it's definitely one of those examples where mating is the last thing that you do in your life.
Yeah. There's a crazy one called the male wasp, or the male wasp spider does something even like, is related, but it's even more gruesome, where they don't actually have external genitalia necessarily. So they'll ejaculate, and then they have like a little appendage, like an arm or something, and they push it inside of the female and break it off. And then immediately the female eats them.
Well, you know, she needs some nourishment here.
Yeah,
she's with child.
It's
a long day.
Yeah.
She needs a snack.
Wow.
Wait, so is this wasp spider a spider or a wasp?
A spider.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's not very good naming.
Yeah.
Whoever named it. Boo. But speaking of cool names, the animal I want to share with the world is called a Peepa Peepa. It's very, very cute.
That's a cute name.
And that's as cute as it goes.
It sounds like a child's cartoon.
Peepa Peepa, also known as the Suriname toad. The toad itself, it's pretty cute. It's kind of stocky. It's kind of flat. It's brown. Another disclaimer. I'm going to describe this animal, and it sounds both gross and fascinating. If you want to learn more, I just want to warn you, if you Google it, the images are a little bit unsettling.
Oh my.
Because it's a little bit unnatural. So when the female Peepa Peepa toad lays a bunch of eggs and the males come to seminate the eggs, mm-hmm. he rubs the eggs across her back.
Okay.
And so all these eggs that are fertilized are on her back, and the eggs sink into her skin, the skin of her back. They all kind of become pockets. And it looks like a weird irregular beehive.
Okay.
You know, when you have a rash and you have a bunch of bumps next to each other, it kind of looks like that, but it's across this toad's back. And so these become little pockets and eventually become little cell chambers where the eggs, they fertilize. And usually, you know, with frogs and toads, they become tadpoles and then they grow feet and become frogs or toads.
Right.
The tadpole stage is completely and entirely, it happens in her back.
Oh my God.
And so when it's time for, you know, the babies to come out from her back, they're already baby toads. And so you have this weird Frankenstein growth on her back that looks like a horrible rash.
It's pulsating.
It is pulsating. And these little frogs like shoot out of her back from these bubbles. It makes me realize that nature is so messed up. Because you look at it, and you're like, that is so unnatural.
It makes me think of, you know, in like the space anime or the like Robotech, where you've got the ships with all the missiles fire out all at once. I'm imagining, except it's little baby toads.
It is. They shoot out and they begin their lives. It is very, very fascinating. I'm oddly fascinated by this, but when you look at the pictures, just be warned. It's
just frogs, just like popping off like gremlins off another frog.
Yeah,
it's almost like a Lovecraft, you know, kind of weird creature. Yeah.
Nothing that man can think up in terms of science fiction stories is crazier and creepier and more disgusting than nature. So, everyone, in the grand tradition of radio, from which podcast came from, I've prepared for you all a lovely little narrative story. It is called
Story
the Dog.
Time.
It is called The Dog with Pika.
Ooh, are you doing voices too?
Sorry, so, what is Pika?
It'll come out in the story. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Gather around, children.
So
Scooch.
There once was a 15-year-old boy who lived in St. Paul, Minnesota back in the 1930s. And he had a little mixed breed dog whose name was Spike. He was white with black spots. They think he was part pointer and part something else. And Spike had a little habit of eating things that were not food.
Which a lot of dogs do.
Yes,
right?
Yes. Okay. But over the course of Spike's time on Earth, he would eat handkerchiefs. He would eat stockings. He once ate a highlight ball. More worryingly for his owners, Spike would eat pins and tacks. And Spike would eat nails. And Spike would even eat razor blades. So amazingly, Spike must have had a real iron stomach because all of these things, he would poop them out without incident.
Even the razor blades,
tacks, nails, everything.
Wow.
Now this disease this syndrome, this phenomenon is known as pica in humans and in animals. Mm-hmm. It's consuming things that are not food.
Right.
Sometimes this can be psychological, you know, just for some reason people start doing it because they acquire the taste for it. Pregnant women can like crave dirt or, you know, or crazy things their brain is telling them they should consume.
Whoa. Like the toilet paper.
Or sometimes people, and certainly dogs, can start doing it because of an imbalance of nutrients. Like if you're iron deficient, you might start eating metal.
Mm-hmm. You actually seek it out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they say that, you know, if a dog eats metal and likes it, he'll just keep eating metal, you know?
They are dogs.
Sure.
Now, these days, a family whose dog did this would probably take the dog to the vet or call Cesar Milan or, you know, whatever, and try to, like, work this out. But, of course, back in the 30s in St. Paul, Minnesota, like, it's a dog. If the dog eats things and dies, you get another dog. You know what I mean? Like, you know.
But also not leave out nails and tacks and razor blades.
Well, also, you wouldn't leave that stuff out. But if the dog is going to go up and start eating them, it's sort of like, you know, the mindset at that time is just sort of like, well, it's a dog, you know. But what that young boy did do was he wrote into a popular newspaper feature series at the time called Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Oh!
And he wrote all about his dog Spike, who would eat tacks and nails and razor blades and things like that. And he wrote about it, and because Ripley's Believe It or Not, of course, had Robert Ripley's illustrations of all of the crazy things that Ripley would encounter as in his world travels, and he would draw them. That was the whole kind of the allure. That boy drew a little picture of his dog, and they actually published it in Ripley's Believe It or Not, credited to that young man. And that little boy grew up to be Charles Schulz, creator of the comic strip
Snoopy,
Peanuts, and creator of Snoopy. And yes, and that little, you know, the little dog that he drew for Ripley's Believe It or Not, who ate tacks and nails and razor blades, his dog Spike,
and
you know, was clearly the real life inspiration for Snoopy.
And excuse me, Peanuts,
there's a Spike.
I may be stealing your thunder here, but Snoopy's brother was named Spike.
Was named Spike, indeed, yes. Yes.
I didn't know Snoopy had a brother.
Snoopy has a massive extended family.
I remember Spike was the one. He lived out in Arizona, and he had like a little pencil mustache, right? Yeah. He was like the Badlands version of Snoopy.
He had a little pencil mustache.
I think
he did. Right? Like a hat and like...
And anyway, you can't do one of these stories without finishing it. And now you know the rest.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Wow.
That is really good. One of the things that interested me when I was doing some of the animal research I kept coming back to is host manipulation. Are you guys familiar with this concept?
It sounds like some alien stuff.
Yeah, it is. You know, in fact, it is very much like alien. So it's sort of related to parasitism and symbiosis. But host manipulation is basically the phenomenon where one animal takes over another animal and basically turns it into a zombie, for lack of a better word. So there have been a lot of these stories on the internet in the last few years. You may have heard of zombie snails or zombie ants or zombie caterpillars or zombie crabs. And this is what they're talking about is host manipulation. So the one that was just in the news recently, I guess, there's a fungus in Brazil. This attacks Brazilian ants. And what the fungus will do is it attaches to the ant's body and makes its way into the ant's brain and will start controlling the ant's brain and nervous system. And at that point, the ant is still alive, but this fungus is basically dictating its actions. It's like a zombie. Whoa. So what the fungus will do is manipulate the ant to climb as high as it can on trees and get it up, way up, and basically affix itself to the tree. So the ant can't move. It's stuck there. And then the fungus continues to grow and continues to grow until it reaches enough of a state that it can break out of the ant's body and then propagate on that part of the tree. So it's moving the ant into a place where it can reproduce more.
Because it can't move by itself.
That's right, that's right.
Oh my God, that's so scary.
It is so weird.
The thing is, it's not like a lot of the zombie ants or zombie cockroaches. It's like another insect or another creature affecting another creature. This is a fungus.
Yeah.
It's like, it's weird hive mind plague, like collective thinking. Like, it's not like they have a central nervous system.
Right.
I mean, like, I think we hear these stories and we want to, like, assign some motivation to the infesting, but it's even harder with a fungus, as you say. Yeah.
Right.
Some of the ones that get even crazier are where there are two or three stages involved. So the zombie snails, and again, talking about things that are hard to look at on the internet. If you just Google or go on YouTube, you'll find this eventually, the zombie snails, but
Be warned. There's pulsing involved.
Fairly warned. So there are flatworms, and what the flatworm, it's a life cycle. So I'll jump in at one point in the life cycle. So the snails eat these flatworm eggs, and the eggs will hatch inside the snail's stomach into little brood sacs. And even just the word, I'm already creeped out.
I like it, actually. It sounds like a baby Bjorn kind of thing.
Yeah. Your brood sac.
Oh, he's sleeping in the brood sac. Be quiet. Oh, we put these on the registry. We got two brood sacs. So they'll navigate into the snail's eye stalks, the tentacles that they use to sense light and navigate around with, and they hijack them. They take over the snail's stalks, and they are literally pulsating and moving with the little flatworm brood sacs in there. So what they do is they short-circuit the snail's ability to sense light, and they drive the snail essentially into light open areas, making it visible for its predators, like birds, for instance. So a bird will come down and eat the snail, or sometimes even just eat the eye stalks. That's all really you need.
Because it looks like a worm.
Right. It's writhing around and pulsating. Exactly. That's the other part of it, right, is that it kind of attracts the bird's attention.
Hey. So. Come eat me.
Hey, bird.
I'm a writhing brood sac inside of an eye stalk. It wriggles in a way to suggest just that sentence.
Yeah. I mean, we've all been in singles bars. We all know how this works, right?
I'm so drunk. Oh, my God. There are no guys who want to talk to
you. You shouldn't buy me any more drinks.
I'm so drunk.
So these brood sacs encased in the tentacles of the snail, well, they end up inside the bird's stomach, and that's where they finish their gestation cycle. So they essentially lay more eggs inside the bird. The bird poops out the eggs.
And the snails eat the poop.
That's right. And then you're back at the beginning of the life cycle with these poor zombie snails.
The circle of life.
It's beautiful.
Beautiful in its own way. Beautiful in its horrific terror.
Okay, Mother Nature is beautiful, but Mother Nature is a twisted woman who all of this is by design. Like, it's not, this is how these flatworms exist. It's by design that they infect the eye stalks, and it's like, man.
I think we nailed it earlier. I think that Mother Nature is a Lovecraft fan. I think
she is. Gross.
Yeah.
Obviously, a lot of these animal stories it's always about reproduction, and which is a good segue because we're gonna take a break and we're gonna do a mnemonic today.
Oh, good. Never taking a break.
And our mnemonic today is kind of related. It is, how do I put this? It is This will be very helpful for biology students.
Sure. And men students, perhaps.
Men who are interested in men's health, or anybody.
Women who are interested.
If you happen to be a budding urologist, maybe you're
completing
your studies.
So today's mnemonic is helps you remember the sperm pathway through the male reproductive tract, how the sperm moves from point A to point B.
The various parts of the anatomy involved.
And right. In a human.
I think this was on ER at one point.
Really?
As in this mnemonic, yes.
It is 7-UP. S-E-V-E-N and up.
Okay. And what does that stand for?
Kind of fitting. 7-UP. It stands for, so S, the first letter of each of the word. So the first S is seminiferous tubules. E stands for epididymis.
Uh-huh.
V stands for vas deferens. The second E is ejaculatory duct. And the N actually stands for nothing.
Okay.
Okay.
So it's not a perfect mnemonic, but yet you just have to remember that that doesn't mean anything.
Up, it's better than Sevi up.
Yeah, Sevi up. Seven up. So N for nothing.
Okay.
And then up, urethra and penis.
Okay.
Whoa.
Okay. So once again from the top.
Seminiferous tubules, epididymis, vas deferens, ejaculatory duct, nothing, urethra, and penis.
Yeah.
Yay, penis.
I have passed my bars. I'm now a licensed urologist.
The standards in California are shockingly low. There's only one question
you
on the exam.
You just need to memorize that mnemonic.
Chris Kohler, penis doctor.
Hello, PhD. I'm Chris Kohler, freelance urologist.
You should, like, snap a glove while you do it.
Why is your business card written on the back of a bus transfer?
So hopefully no one will ever forget how a sperm travels through a human male reproductive tract.
I just hope that there is some listener out there, and he or she's in medical school, and is like, yes, I need to know this.
Right. A lot of mnemonics get used in medical school. I have been led to believe that, I mean, because you have to memorize, like, you have to memorize all the different pathways that things take in the body.
And just the volume of information.
Yeah, and so you've got to, it's got to be like this, then this, then this, then this, then this, then this, then this. And so you come up with mnemonics to help you do that.
And I'm chances sure are, someone needs the sperm pathway.
Maybe it's you.
Yeah, you never know. Maybe, you know, submit your favorite medical mnemonics to gjb.podcast@gmail.com. One may appear in a future episode.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Okay, jumping back to our weird animal topic. I change shapes just to hide in this place, but I'm still an animal. Nobody knows it but me when I slip. Yeah, I slip, I'm still an animal. There are a lot of everyday things that we as humans use that you don't know, animals are somehow involved in them.
Right.
And in past episodes, we talked about, you know, the civet coffee and the anal beaver juice used to flavor vanilla. And we have a bunch more.
The one that I always like, just because it's so simple, and after you hear it, you're like, oh, is shellac. You know, we know shellac, the thinner you varnish thing, or not varnish, but you cover things. It's shellac comes from the shell of the lac beetle.
What?
Yes. The lac, the L-A-C, shell plus lac, shellac.
Shellac comes from a lac shell.
So, yes, exactly. So, specifically...
I thought shellac is used for what, like furniture? Like,
oh, man, it has... So, the more I read into this, it had all these uses that I didn't even know that it had. So, I mean, the typical
use... You can
use,
put it in your coffee.
Yeah, it tastes... Well, actually, it is edible. It is non-toxic.
You can eat shellac.
Well, so we all... I think that we all know a shellac mostly from wood and furniture and, you know, walls or things like that. So, you know, but it is edible. It's non-toxic. It's fully organic. One of the uses of it that I didn't know this, if you ever eat on like pills or candies, you know, it's got the little glossy coating, mm-hmm. that's shellac.
Huh.
If you see on ingredients for something, if you see pharmaceutical glaze or confectioner's glaze, that's shellac.
They put bugs on everything.
I think sure. I had always thought that confectioner's glaze was, like sugar-based or something. No, confectioner's glaze, pharmaceutical glaze, food-grade glaze is all shellac.
At least it's not snail's eye stalks or whatever. Like,
hey, you never know.
It's on something. It's probably in donuts.
And it's interesting the way they harvest it. So I guess I had assumed it came straight from the shells. Specifically the female lac beetle, only the female lac beetle for some reason. They leave the resin. It's like a resin that they leave on the trees where they live. They make these little tube-like tunnels to move from branch to branch. So what people will do is they harvest these little tubes. Huh. They scrape all the resin off. You melt it down. You filter out the debris. So it's liquid, and then you let it cool into sheets, and then they break it up grind it into a powder. And then when you're ready to use it as shellac, you dissolve the powder in alcohol.
That sounds really labor intensive.
Yes. It takes thousands and thousands of individual beetles' contributions just to make, you know, a few hundred grams of shellac.
So how do they make it today?
The same process. The process is unchanged. Yeah, it's harvested. The beetles leave it behind. You can't force them to produce it. So you harvest it from the trees where they live. You melt it down.
Oh, you're not actually eating the beetles.
It's the resin secreted from the beetle. That's right.
Like honey.
It's secreted from the shell of the lac beetle. Right. Huh. So it's a sort of a byproduct. In addition to the glazes I was just telling you, before they started using vinyl, LPs were made out of shellac. Because if you get it up in a dense enough quantity, you can mold it and form it and press it, and it holds its shape really well.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I always associate shellac, I mean, like at Home Depot, it's always with like varnish or paint thinner or any of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously those to me, you know, are chemicals, are very harsh chemicals, and shellac is...
I had the same assumption, originally. But put it in your coffee. Fully natural. Yeah. And I guess it fell out of favor for more like, you know, synthetic varnishes and things like that, because it's not as durable as like a polyurethane coat.
Good one.
You know, I mean, bugs and insects do all kinds of things naturally, and then once we find out that we can benefit from those products that they produce, you know, it's a question of how do we get them to do it more efficiently, right? And so we have apiculture, right, which is the word for
beekeeping.
But also, I think it can also refer to other type of insect keeping as well, but primarily known for beekeeping, essentially. So primarily, I'll put this question to you guys. What is the primary thing that bees in beekeepers keep bees? What is the primary thing that they keep them to do? Karen.
Honey.
Incorrect. Wrong.
Pollination.
Crops.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about the great state of California, where we all are right now. I found out that California's Central Valley produces somewhere between 2/3 and 75% of all of the almonds used in the world.
Yes.
Wow.
When you eat almonds in Japan, when you eat almonds in China, those almonds probably came from California, where they are raised. California cannot actually grow all of those almonds using just the natural resources in California, okay? The reason we were able to have so many, almond trees and whatnot, you know, planted is because almond trees are very, very resource hungry, and you have to have bees pollinating those trees. You must. You have to have it. But there's not enough bees on all these man-made forests of almond trees, right, to do it. So, there are something on the order of between 2 and 3 million colonies of bees in the U.S. today. A million of those colonies, which aren't actually located in California, are trucked in from the Midwest for almond season. And they actually truck those bees in.
Really?
So that those bees can pollinate the almond trees when it's time to do that in the middle of the season.
They're like vagabond bees.
Oh yeah, well a lot of these bees are from North Dakota, and it's beekeepers in North Dakota and other Midwestern states, and they actually make as much money during the California almond season as they do selling honey.
Yeah. That's amazing.
And the primary use, 2/3 of all of the bee colonies in the US, about are traveling bee colonies. It's the traveling bee circus. And they will come to your town for a fee and pollinate your plants. Because they're actually, there aren't enough bees just naturally hanging around where they actually grow food to grow all that food.
So they're just bees for hire, just they're always
bees,
on the move.
Bees for hire. Here is my card.
Wow.
That is so cool.
So they truck them in, and they pollinate the almonds, and then they truck them back?
And they truck them back home, and they might go off to pollinate some other crop later. They're traveling bees.
That's national, bees national
in the
U.S.
are doing the national, doing the nationwide tour, pollinating your crops. And so basically, the world's almond supply depends on beekeepers who live in North Dakota, you know, coming to California to.
I love the involved nature of these kind of things because I mean I did know that almost all the almonds, I didn't know the exact number, came from Central Valley, but I had no idea that it was so dependent on this other whole other industry in growing them.
Wouldn't it be cool to be the driver of said precious bees?
Yeah.
It's like, what's your job? It's like, you know, I'm the bee handler. Like, I drive these bees around. I get them to the different gigs. They're like the roadie. They're bee roadies.
I smell a Jason Statham movie.
Jason Statham is...
buzzed.
Buzzed. So my weird animal use find is actually... I'm a big Futurama fan, Matt Groening cartoon series, and in one very, very good episode, they talked about ambergris. Mm-hmm. And ambergris is actually, I can never find the right ways to put these things in non-gross words.
Byproduct.
So it is a byproduct. It is a solid waxy byproduct, a substance, and it's produced in the digestive system of sperm whales.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, sperm whales, they eat weird things out in the ocean. They eat like squids and different smaller animals. And things like squids that have beaks or weird sharp cartilage or bones, I mean, that it's a little bit, you know, hard to pass in their digestive system.
Right.
So their systems secrete ambergris to help ease the passage, and it kind of cushions it, and it's waxy and it's soft, and it kind of softens the edges.
Hello, sperm whales. Are you having trouble passing through that latest carapace you accidentally ingested? Try ambergris.
If you Google this and you look at a quote, fresh ambergris, it looks pretty gross.
Never Google image search anything Karen ever mentioned on any of these podcasts ever.
It kind of looks like it's like a weird alien pod.
Right.
It's bumpy and it's kind of waxy and kind of shiny and it's gray and
how
it's
do they
green.
Get it?
Here's the fun fact. Ambergris gets built up, you know, as the sperm eats all the beaks and the weird things in the ocean. And the sperm whales puke it out. They puke out and it gets washed up onto shore.
Right. Oh.
And so fresh ambergris, when you see it on the shore, it looks like kind of like an alien baby.
Oh.
And it smells like what you would think whale vomit smells like.
Right. That's I had always heard. I wasn't totally sure how it created, but I had always heard that it was just smells absolutely foul.
Okay.
Just completely
disgusting.
But it has uses.
It does. And so here's some adjectives describing the smell of ambergris. Fishy, fecal, foul, oily. But the thing is, and I don't know, and this goes
sold.
This goes back to like who found out about this, because after a long time of oxidation, ambergris, the substance, that particular odor actually starts becoming sweet smelling and musky.
Right.
It's dated back, the ancient Egyptians actually would burn ambergris as kind of like incense because it would release a nice odor after oxidation, not the fishy state. And in modern Egypt, they actually use ambergris for scenting cigarettes. Around the world, ambergris was used in perfumes and colognes.
Like a perfume base, right? Or a base for it, right?
For that musky smell. Obviously, a lot of people raise a stink about it because they're like, oh, it's animal.
No pun intended.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, oh, we don't want animal products in our perfumes or in our cosmetics.
Right.
So now people have used some sort of synthetic agents, but like the real hardcore old school perfumeries still use whale vomit in their base.
I know how they figured out that if you let it oxidize, it smells sweet. Like, who wants to touch fishy poo smelling crap on the
beach?
They
just leave it out.
Leave it, and then
they'll
come
back the next day to see if it's gone. It's not gone, but it actually smells better.
They're like, it couldn't smell any worse if we leave it here.
It doesn't smell that bad anymore.
Does it smell good? Or does it just not smell as bad?
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
So speaking of kind of surprising ingredients to food, I found out that a lot of bagels and some baby foods and other personal products have... It's not that bad. It's a little weird. It's duck feathers and human hair. There's this enzyme in both of those called L-cysteine. Okay. And it's a dough conditioner, so it makes bagels softer. And there's a way to make it synthetically, but it's really expensive. So, like, your bagel might have, ground up duck feathers or human hair.
It goes into the dough, or it's in the...
Into the dough.
Okay.
It's an ingredient.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Ground up duck feathers.
It must have a different name.
Yeah.
They did
whatever.
Why it's disguised with the scientific name, that's where it comes from.
Sure. Yeah. Well, yeah, like anal beaver juice. Yeah.
Sure.
Castoreum.
Yeah,
exactly. Right.
That sounds so exotic. It's butt juice.
I like bagels. I'm sure I've eaten a lot of hair bagels in my day.
Yeah. A restaurant, there might be hair in your food anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Oh, foodception.
Yeah.
Food in your food, in your food. In your food.
In your hair. Back in your food.
Circle of life.
Give us another rendition of Circle.
In the circle. The circle of life.
With duck feathers.
Not that this is our intended goal for this podcast, but I think we, now with 10 episodes, we have a nice list of foods that, you know, a lot of us will never ever touch because we found out what's actually in them.
Can't eat bagels.
Can't eat
M&M's because they have shellac on
them. I've been drinking confectioner's glaze by the gallon, and now I'm just going to have to curb that habit.
No more pills.
So that was our weird animal talk, and we are heading into our final quiz segment. And this is my quiz, and it's not too much of like a quiz, but more like a kind of a discussion. Famous paradoxes, and this will come in handy during pub quiz or any trivia competition you're in, because there are a couple of famous ones, and here are some that you know you might eventually get asked about. Get your buzzers
all right,
ready.
All right. Okay.
Tell me what is Catch 22.
Oh, okay.
Colin.
Catch 22, if I remember, was to in the novel, the Heller novel, in order to be disqualified from flight service, you had to be insane, I guess, for lack of a better word. But in order to document that you were insane, proved that you had the capacity to recognize that you were sane. Is that close?
It is very close. So a catch 22 generally is described as a situation where a person cannot avoid a problem because of contradictory constraints or rules. So in this case, what's the character? Doc, right? Doc said, why any pilot requesting a psych evaluation hoping to be found not sane enough to fly and thereby escape dangerous missions would thereby demonstrate his sanity?
Ah, okay.
So that is the catch 22. What is Zeno's paradox?
Chris.
Zeno's paradox is, Zeno, the ancient Greek, right, said, if I'm walking to this, from here to this wall, I'm never going to get to the wall, because first I have to travel half the distance, and then I have to travel half of that distance, and then I have to travel half of that distance, and then half of that distance, which means that I'll never ever get to the wall, because there'll always be some distance between me and the wall.
More specifically, he was describing a imaginary race between Achilles and the tortoise, right?
Isn't that really what
it was, right?
Oh,
so okay. I believe the example he gave was that it doesn't matter that Achilles is the fastest being in existence.
Oh, he'll never catch
if you
up
give
to
the
tortoise.
Right, exactly. That he'll never be able to pass the tortoise because in the time that he goes his distance, the tortoise has moved a little bit.
And right. Yes.
Basically, any distance can be broken down or, you know, on paper can be broken down into infinite little fractions of distance, and you can never catch on.
You can have something infinite times.
Obviously, this is not true, because then that means any movement is impossible. But it's a good thinker.
But it's one of those where even though you know it's not true instinctively, explaining why to somebody pretending to be the devil's advocate.
That, exactly. That's the intellectual exercise here. It's to answer the question and kind of square the circle and explain why it's false.
Right, right.
Okay, this is a big one. What is the liar paradox?
I'm going to guess it's something related to the concept of this statement is not true.
Correct.
All right.
Very correct.
Really? Is that it?
Yeah. Liar paradox is this sentence is false.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of like there's a whole series of them. You know, opposite day is one of them. Today is opposite day. Well, so if it's opposite day,
then it's not opposite
day. It's all these like kind of self-referential paradoxes. Another one is it's called the Socratic paradox, which Socrates says, "I know that I know nothing at all." What is the ship of Theseus? It's also known as the George Washington's axe paradox.
You're up on your paradoxes.
I know my paradoxes. Yeah. The ship of Theseus, I believe, is the one. It's a philosophical mind exercise where if a ship goes out to sea and replacements or repairs are being made on it as it goes. It breaks in half, essentially. Yes. I've heard two variations. One is that the ship breaks in half and each half is repaired back. Which one is the ship of Theseus? I've heard another variation, which is the ship goes out to sea. If it's replaced piece by piece over the course of the voyage, by the time it comes back, is it the same
ship?
Is
it the same ship? It's about George Washington's axe one is. Oh, I've had this axe since I was a young boy. I replaced the handle. And then later I replaced the head. But I've had this axe forever.
I haven't heard that one. I like that.
And lastly, this is so interesting. It's called the Abilene Paradox.
Mm.
And I don't think this is general knowledge, so I'll explain a little bit. So basically, we know the Abilene Paradox in play. We just don't know what's called the Abilene Paradox. So basically, the belief is that people can make decisions based not on what they actually personally want to do, but what they think other people want to do.
Mm.
So as a result, everybody ends up doing something they think the other person wants to do, but nobody wants to do it themselves. So this stems from, this is kind of the fundamental of a lot of groupthink or decision theory. And this paradox was kind of posed, or the story behind it is, like, we have a group of family. They live in Texas. It was a super hot day. They're having a fun time hanging out on the porch playing dominoes or whatever. And then the dad was like, thinking to himself, he's like, well, I don't want anybody to be bored. So he suggested, hey, why don't we go to Abilene, which is a 50-mile drive over there. It's a town in Texas, and have dinner there. And the wife is like, she personally thinks, well, I don't really want to go, but it sounds like you want to go. So sure, that sounds great.
Right.
And then the brother's like, well, if you guys want to go, then I'll go. Sounds great. And everybody ends up on the car 50 miles in super hot weather to Abilene, have a crappy dinner and come back. And they're like, man, that wasn't worth it. That food was good.
And they're like, why did we go?
Why did we go? It's just everybody decided on what they think another person wants
to do. I've definitely gone through situations like that in my life. Yeah.
Especially with a girlfriend or a boyfriend, a spouse. What do you want to eat?
Right.
Do you want Mexican food? Well, I don't want Mexican. Do you want Mexican food?
I only suggested that because I thought you didn't want it. Yeah.
So Abilene Paradox.
The Abilene Paradox.
And we have another carryover listener challenge for this week, and I actually wrote this myself, so it'll be very hard to Google, but you would need some Googling. It's very clever, and it's very fun. I hope
if you do say so yourself.
I hope you guys enjoy it, and here it is. It's a form of a poem, and I'm going to read it out twice. It's, 19th century is the time you seek, for the great battle was fought on sea. Two sides against one, fleet by fleet, name me the ship of doubled identity.
Mm.
Here it is again. Play it again, Sam. 19th century is the time you seek, for the great battle was fought on sea. Two sides against one, fleet by fleet, name me the ship of double identity.
Get your thinking caps firmly on for this one.
A little bit harder. And if you know the answer, email it to gjb.podcast@gmail.com, and out of all the correct answers, we will select a few random ones and send you some prizes, some cool swag.
And you'll feel smart.
Thanks to you guys for joining me. And thanks to you guys, the listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned a lot about animal stuff and a lot about food that you should avoid because it might be a little bit gross. You can find us on Zune Marketplace. You can find us on iTunes and also on our website, goodjobbrain.com. If we enrich your lives, give us a review on iTunes. Throw in some alliteration in there while you're at it.
We don't ask for much.
We read them and we laugh.
We like them. Yeah, we love them. So yeah, and we'll see you guys next week. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that, because you're already listening to a podcast.